Okay, so let's start the second half of the morning session. So the speaker is Nicolas Rigneau from the quantum superposition, as you mentioned, of École Normale Supérieure and Princeton University, and he assured us that there is a plus sign in between these two institutions.
Yeah, I've checked that before.
So anyways, he's going to be talking about topological materials from a catalog to machine learning.
Okay, so thank you. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's a real pleasure to be back in, at KITP. So it's going to be slightly different from the two previous talks about VIL fermions. I will try to give you some work we have done to systematically go through database of materials and try to find all the topological materials that you have in there. And from that, try to get some insight using machine learning on what are the ingredients to have a topological material. So this work involved lots of people. So these people are my collaborators on the paper, on the catalog of topological materials. And I should really acknowledge Maya, who is here, because before starting this project, I knew nothing about ab initio calculations. And now I know not much, but still. So thanks to her. And when it comes to the machine learning part, the work was actually done by Nicolas Clausen, who was doing an internship with me in Paris at that time, and now is a grad student at UCSB. And his role is really the driving force behind this project. And these are the two references that we'll discuss today. So let's talk about, first, this catalog of material. So the idea is the following. With the advancement of characterizing topological properties through symmetry, you have a series of papers back in 2016-17 that really gave a procedure to find if a material is topological, if topology is due to crystalline symmetry. Now, if you look at the materials, what kind of ingredients that we have, and especially those we plug into the ab initio calculation. Well, we have the space group, which is just a set of symmetries that define the crystal structure in three dimensions. So it's a combination of the lattice translations, the point group operations, and the non-symmorphic transformation. And so on top of the symmetry group, we have only 230 of them in three dimensions. We have to say which atoms we have, and where are they localized, and which orbitals are involved in the band structure. So with this ingredients here, we can wonder, well, how we go from this real space information to the electronic band structure, and without any Hamiltonian, let's say. So what we have in mind is the atomic limit. And this is tightly related to, well, this is the notion of elementary band representation that was used a lot by Andre and collaborators to discuss about topological quantum chemistry. So basically, even if you fix the symmetry group, let's say you work in two dimension, there are several ways to arrange the atom within the unit cell, and well, all the atoms, of course, are related by symmetry, so that you have the example of triangle lattice with one atom per unit cell, the honeycomb lattice, and the Kagome lattice. But even if you pick, let's say, this guy here, you still have multiple choice for the electronic orbitals for a given arrangement. So you can have here S or PZ orbitals, and here PX and PY orbitals. And so what the elementary band representation tells you is the following. Can we build all the possible band structure for these cases in the atomic limit? And the key insight that was actually derived in the early 80s by Zach Bakri and Michel was that you can actually think about this calculation as the band representation. And as soon as you have a possession of symmetries, you can wonder, what are the irreducible representation? And that's what we call the EBR. And what several groups did was basically to find all the possible IREPs in that case. And they are all tabulated once and for all the symmetry groups and all the possible high symmetry positions that you can have for all these lattices. And you can get them from the Bilbao grid crystallographic server. And from the band representation, you can really get also access to the IREPs in the Brillouin zone at the high symmetry points, the high symmetry line. And by construction, a band representation is an atomic limit. and vice versa, all after making it yield a Banner representation. So I will follow the language of the topological quantum chemistry here. And TQC provides a unified framework for the treatment of all topological phases that arise from crystalline symmetries. And it relies on two ingredients. The first one is the EBR, I just discussed, which enumerates all the base. It's like creating a basis for all the possible electronic bands induced by the atomic orbitals, the atomic limits, and compatibility relation that basically tells you, for example, if you have the description of what's going on at the high symmetry point, how to connect these points through the Brillouin zone. And the key point is the following, is that all set of bands not induced from these symmetric localized orbitals are topologically non-trivial. So my is just to say that if you cannot connect to one of these atomic limits, then you have an obstruction and you do have some topology. So you have many cases that can arise. Let's start with insulators. So imagine that your Wolf system, so that's the energy, that's the momentum, these are the high symmetry points, and you connect them by the band structure. And let's say you have two elementary band representations for this system. So the band representation should be a sum of these irreducible representations, so with integer and positive weights. So this is the Fermi energy. In that case, these two group of bands correspond, each of them, to one EBR. And since the Fermi level goes through here and clearly separate them, well, the band representation for the bands below the Fermi level are just given by the first EBR. So this system is trivial. Or at least you can, if trivial in a sense, there is no topology coming from the crystalline symmetry. Now, of course, you can have an obstruction to that, and you have two cases. The first one is split EBR. So this time, this group of band from the second EBR is split by the energetics, and this is where the Fermi level here is. And if you want the band below the Fermi level, the better representation for below the Fermi level, is the sum of the first EBR and half of the second EBR. So it's not connected to a sum of two EBR with integer weight. So this one is topologically non-trivial. That's another case where basically the bands below the Fermi level are a mixture with fractional weights of the two EBRs. So once again, you get something non-trivial. And if you have heard about fragile topology, this is the case where the sum of the EBRs can have integer weights, but one of them has a negative factor, meaning that you can trivialize your bands by adding a trivial band. If you think about the Chern insulator, for example, we know that if you have a Chern band, if you want to make the whole system trivial, you have to include another non-trivial band. So that's the usual topology. The fragile one, you can make it trivial by adding just a trivial band. So that was for the insulators. We can move to semi-metal. Look at the topological semi-metals here. So it's roughly the same story. You have two classes, the enforced semi-metals and the enforced semi-metal with the Fermi degeneracy. The second one is basically when the high symmetry point, and there's a degeneracy at the high symmetry point exactly at the Fermi level, which is the case here. And the enforced semi-metal, the degeneracy is away from this high symmetry point. So these are the five classes. Well, if you want, you have three classes, which is basically the trivial insulator, the topological insulator, and the topological semi-metal. And you can subdivide the TIs into the NLC and SCBR, and the topological semi-metal into ES and ESFTs. So with that in mind, with these two in hand, we can start the procedure of going through all the known materials. So don't be scared by this diagram here. Let me guide you a little bit. So what we have done is the following. We have the ABD show code VASP that we use. We have the database, the ICSD, which contains more than 200,000 materials that have been synthesized. And we have all the information about the band representation on the BBOG cryptographic server. So basically, by combining these three guys here, we're able to first feed the VAS code with all the materials from the ICSD, do the calculation, and then characterize each material one by one. And from that, we can know if the material is a TI, if this is temperature semi-metal, and so on. To do this search, we have to be a bit careful because some of the data here are not really friendly for ab initio calculation. So we had to remove some of them. So at the end of the day, when you filter out, let's say, the good data, we have something of the order of 70,000-75,000 ICSDs, which will boil down to 38,000 unique materials. Some materials will have more than one ICSD data entry. And we use three different supercomputers. I ended up with 20 million CPU hours to run everything. And at the end, the main result, I mean, the most striking one was basically that topology is not rare. At least in this survey, if you look at the the statistics, we have, of course, a large amount of trivial materials, 47%, but kind of a high, I mean, number of TIs, 16%, and also a pretty decent number of topological semi-metals. All the data that we have generated is available publicly. So you can go to this website here and try to find your material and see if you have the complete characterization from the topological point of view. If you prefer to, if you work with the Materials Project website, there is now topological information for many materials, and they will point out to our website. So that's basically the core of this paper here. But at the same time, two other papers were published. One by the group of Sheng Feng, and another one by the group of Ashwin Vishwanath. And I also put the link here of Chen's website, which is also pretty interesting to look at. It's always good to have, you know, two sources of information so you can compare that we have the correct result. So that's the first the paper I've mentioned. We only look at the high-quality compounds, so those are is simple to synthesize, and it was only around 25,000 materials. But we are keeping updating the doing calculations, and there will soon be a new version of the website available, which will provide a few things more user-friendly, much more options in terms of search, so you can look for the best TI with that symmetry group with that type of atoms, with the, let's say, the largest gap. We have at the end, so as I said, more than 38,000 unique materials. An information that is missing right now is you can also compare what's going on if you turn off the spin orbit coupling. Dynamical plots for band structure, for the density of states. You have all the information about fragile phases, which will be provided there. And hopefully we'll also have a wiki where you can find more information about how we generated the data and potential caveats and things like that. And this is basically how it would look like when you try to get information about one material here, bismuth telluride. And for example, I'm not sure that you see here, but you have information about the fragile bands. So with that in hand, we might wonder, look, we have a large amount of data. There is all this business of machine learning. Can we do something with that? And can we get some physical insight out of it? So just a brief reminder of the machine learning story. Basically, what we want to learn is a function. If you're French, what you want to discriminate is between a croissant and a chocolate croissant. So we have a function for that in France. And we want to get a very good approximation using, let's say, for example, neural network. So the input data is basically a picture. And we want, at the end, a label that will say, OK, this is this or that. And of course, the rule of the game is to find the best approximation for the exact function. So how do we train such a system? Well, there are many ways. The first one is called supervised learning. Basically, you train your network with a large amount of information. with you have a pair of input and output or label. And what you do is basically you reduce a cost function that measures the distance between the output and what your function will provide. And then you optimize all the parameters that you have in this big box using an algorithm like gradient descent. And of course, you have to verify that everything works well, that you didn't do any overfit. I mean, if you have enough parameters bigger than, let's say, your sample, then of course you will be able to encode everything with this. But you want this, your model to be, I mean, to be flexible or to be able to adapt to new situation. So you need to test that you didn't do any overfitting. Other techniques also can be involved unsupervised learning, where you will let the algorithm find itself the how to separate the data into subgroups. You can use reinforced learning. This is typically, I'm sure that you have seen some videos of some network playing video games trying to increase the high score. That's the kind of technique they use. Let's go back to our problem and ask the following questions. So what do we have? Well, that's what we provide basically to the ab initio calculation, the crystallographic data. So we have a chemical composition, we have the symmetry group, the number of atoms, the orbitals that are involved in the process. So that's what we want to provide to, let's say, to our network. We have, I would say, a large amount of data, but you have to be careful that this is not large in the context of machine learning. So it's still a pretty small sample. And it's even worse than that. If you look per symmetry group, sometimes you have symmetry groups with only three elements, like 97 out of my head. Other symmetry group will have a few thousand. And moreover, even if you look globally speaking, you have more trivial than TIs or topological semi-metals. So that's, for example, the number of materials, not per symmetry group, because it would be like a massive plot, but just by point group. So in blue, you have the trivial materials, in orange, the TIs, in green, the topological semi-metal. That's a log scale. And you see, for example, there is like something or the other of a unit here for the point group 9, and something or the other of a few thousand for the point group 5. There is another problem. So we have a small sample, and in terms of data per sample, we have lots of information. And there is a chance that you have, much more information than the sample size, and this is called the curse of high dimensions. Your algorithm will not be flexible enough or be, plagued by overfitting. And there is also a non-trivial question, is how to encode the information. And if you think just about the position of the atom, that's not something that is trivial. Just rotate the basis and you will change completely the coordinates, but you didn't change the physical system. So there are like a large literature, especially in chemistry, where people have tried to find way to encode in a way that does not depend on the basis. But it's not completely obvious. But even like encoding a chemical structure can be, is not as easy as expected. So, if you hear about machine learning, you hear a lot about deep learning and neural network and things like that, but that's not the only technique that they have in the field. And if you think about deep learning, you have so many parameters, and more is not necessarily better. So you have to find the right architecture for your problem. And that's what basically Nicolas did to move away from, from a neural network and use another tool, which is called which is a generalization of decision trees. So first, we have data that says you have different types. I mean, you have chemical information and positions. If you think about the picture, it's only about pixels and the intensity of each pixel. These picture would be called structured data, and what we have is unstructured data. And so, what is decision tree? They work pretty well for unstructured data. So let me give you a very simple example. So imagine that you want to have, a function that tells you where are the tori in the plot. Well, what you can do is the following. You can make this kind of tree where you say, well, If the y coordinate is larger than yc, then I know its sphere. If it's smaller than yc, I have to do another test where I look if x is lower or bigger than xc, and from there I can decide if this is a sphere or a torus. Of course, in general, you are more in a situation like this where you will be almost capture what's going on. Of course, you have a few outliers like these two guys here. There are many improved versions of this. The one that we use is called gradient boosted trees, where basically you will train an ensemble of this decision trees, but with a small depth. And that's really pretty useful to avoid the overfitting problem. And you don't have to, encode your own algorithm. You have, lots of toolbox available. And for boosted tree, we use actually the XG boost. So what do we have? What do we provide? We provide the number of electrons. And there is a nice way to encode it. It's basically using a description in terms of binary numbers. The reason is the following. We know from the topological quantum chemistry that for some symmetry group and some number of electrons, you guarantee, like if the number of electrons is not a multiple of 4, let's say, then it's necessarily an ESFT. So by providing directly the binary description, it's much easier for the network to find this kind of rule. Once again, we don't provide any additional rule at the beginning. We let the algorithm find the rules itself. We provide a symmetry group. We can provide directly the number that people use as a label. We can use a slightly different fingerprint for each group based on, let's say, the proportion of TIs, trivial and semi-metal, that we have in a given SG. So it's not a bias. It's just another way to encode the information, which is pretty convenient. The chemical structure. You can, for example, just provide the average number of SPDF electrons that you have. And also, you can provide the number of atoms in a given column of the periodic table and a number of atoms that you have in a given row of the periodic table. Think about the column. It's pretty natural because we know that elements in the same column, they will have similar chemical properties. And one optional case that we have considered also is the position of the atom within the unit cell. And we can encode this, for example, as the average of the distance between the atoms in the unit cell or the variance or different algorithms. So if you look at the paper we have, we discuss all the cases that we have looked at. And the output can be of two types. You can just have a coarse grain label, namely, is it trivial, is it a TI, is it a topological semi-metal, or get the full label. That's the number of materials that we have used for training. We save some of them for testing, and we use a cross-validation to estimate the error. And that's the result. So it's a big table. Don't be scared. What you need to focus is basically the first line. So we call it the full model. The vector that you use as an input is a dimension 49. And you see that the accuracy that we get for the result is on the order of 90%. So the full model contains the symmetry grouping information, the number of atoms, and the chemical composition encoded as the orbitals and the number of atoms per row and column in the periodic table. And for example, if you think about as a way to bypass the expensive calculation that you do when you run your ab initio code, if you do the ab initio code with spin orbit coupling, is much more time-consuming than without. So let's say you can do a quick calculation without the spin orbit coupling, and then you provide the result to our network, or to our decision or boosted tree, and with this additional information, you improve a lot by 2 points the accuracy of your result. And especially, as you see here, for the TIs. For example, I was talking about the curse of high dimensions. So when the input vector is too large, especially when you provide the position of the atoms, well, that's exactly what happened here. You take this model and you provide information about the location of the atom by this average distance. And now you see that you don't improve the accuracy, actually slightly decrease. So we don't need this information at the moment. So we have the score here per class. I mean, this is a much better measurement of the accuracy. It's called the F1 score. It's basically the algebraic geometric average between the precision accuracy, which tells you how bad you are at in providing false positive, and the recall will do the same for the false negative. And there is always a trade-off whether you want to favor one or the other, but the F1 score does not depend on that. And you might wonder, I mean, the numbers that you show us, are they much better than just picking randomly, because you have something which is not evenly distributed between TIs and trivial and topological semi-metals? And the answer is yes, by a lot. And maybe the first one of the lesson here, when we look at the result, is how loosely we depend on the position of the atom within the crystal lattice. It's much more important, this average orbital character, to discriminate between trivial and topological. If you want the full label classification, so the final information about TIs and semi-metal, we can do that too, but you have to be careful. That's the result in that case, and you see that not as good as the coarse-grained version. But you have to realize that the sample size start being really small. And also some naive remark. Just imagine that you you have one compound that is it's an NLC, and you make a prediction that this is an SCBR. For the coarse-grained version, still a TI. So it doesn't matter. You get the right result. But for the full label, you get the wrong result. But we also understand why, for example, the SCBR are more harder to find than the NLC, and so are the ES. Basically, the ES, or for the ESFDs, so where you have the degeneracy happening at the high symmetry point, this one, you can get the information sometimes just by looking at the symmetry group and the number of electrons. So that's why these guys are really easy to detect. Similarly for SCBR, the splitting of a set of bands, this is due to energetic. So it's much more tricky to infer, even from from a physical point of view.
Can you do the second one?
The second one?
No, this CBR, ES,
and ES, ES. So these are the two types of topological insulators that you can have, the way the band representation will, that's what I was discussing here. Right, that's the two cases which are not just linear combination of EBR. And that's the two types of topological semi-metal. Yeah, I should put labels like on top of them. We might want to analyze a bit more what's going on in this procedure. What's the algorithm is looking for to decide which type you have. If you want to do that for the gradient boosted tree, it's not completely trivial to do the analysis, but we can do, let's say, a simpler model. So just one decision tree. It would be a bit bigger, but at least it might give you some idea how it works. So this is the result of training of a simple tree. Actually, it's a bit bigger in principle, but just to fit in one slide, we have just glued together a bunch of boxes. So for example, the first thing that the algorithm will check is the number of electrons and decide if, depending on this number and the symmetry group, if this is a topological semi-metal or not. Then if it's not the case, that you will dive a bit deeper about the properties of the samples, like the number of electrons, the type of chemical constituent, and so on and so forth. So overall, the accuracy of this very simple tool, decision tree, is not as big as the one that we have for the full one. It's only 70%. But at least we can understand every of these boxes and try to see how it works. And if you are interested in, of course, we have a website where you can just go there, you put your input file that you use for the VAS software, or you can just provide the chemical information yourself, provide a symmetry group, and if you have information about the non-spin orbit coupling, just put it here, you click, and you will get a prediction for the topological properties. Okay, so about the conclusion. So the two things I've discussed here is, thanks to this topological quantum chemistry, we are really able to make this large survey of all the materials. And once again, I think the surprising result here was the amount of non-trivial material that you have in nature. And it was really important to have all this information available to the community. Once again, these are ab initio calculations, so you have to be really careful and take it with a grain of salt, but at least it's a guide for people that want to get an idea. Okay, maybe this compound might have some interesting properties. On the machine learning side, with this amount of data, and if you choose wisely, you're both the algorithm that you want to use and the way you encode the information, you can get some valuable prediction. And maybe the surprising result here is how few information that you really need to make a decision about the nature of a given compound. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for that talk. I actually got stuck in the beginning of your talk. I have maybe a topological trivial question, but you mentioned that your viewpoint is as such that you think about the crystal symmetries and then you use them to classify the topological phases, and you basically that you can think of the bands as representations of the crystallized symmetries.
It's a bit more complex than that.
But okay, but this was kind of the motivation behind.
Let's say if you go ahead.
So the question actually I have is that how uniquely does the symmetry then define the topological phase? Could you have cases when you have a given symmetry and then you have a topological phase and a non-topological phase?
Yeah, that's why I was at least at some point really careful about what you have here, what it does. It's about crystalline symmetries. So for example, think about the Chern insulator, which is maybe the simplest example in two dimension. You might miss this kind of guy because the topology doesn't come from some crystalline symmetry, right? So even in principle, you can have to do the full Wilson loop characterization if you want to be sure that the trivial material is actually trivial. So.
But let's say that you find a topological material, and then can you find with the same symmetry class also a trivial material?
Sorry?
Let's say that you find in some symmetry class, you find topological material. Can you find from the same class also a trivial material?
Yeah, I mean, it depends, for example, of course, on the details of the crystalline structure where the atom are located. So we do have examples, of compound with the same chemical structure, the same symmetry group, but for example, at high pressure or things like that, that will, of course, will turn the materials from, let's say, from trivial to topological. So for example, in the database, what we call unique material, maybe I should be clear about the definition, it's the same chemical composition, the same symmetry group, and the same topological classification. So if you, I could in principle show it here, but if you just enter one case, it will tell you, okay, we have this ICSD that is, for example, or this compound for coming from this ICSD, which is trivial, and the other one, which is topological. So this kind of details we are available.
Here.
Yep.
So can you use your trained network now to classify magnetic compounds?
As to Andre, I mean, first you need to do the TQC, the magnetic version of TQC. So it should be out soon, and then we can play the same game. Unfortunately, as far as I know, they have much less, I mean, compounds available. So all the order of maybe 1,000 I think that's the number. So clearly, doing machine learning here will not help. I mean, it's a sample which is size which is way too small. The good thing here is like we have a large chunk of data, maybe not as large as what Google has about you, but a fairly decent amount of data.
Thanks. Nicolas?
Yeah?
47% sounds very close to 50. Is there any reason
you want to negotiate with me?
Is there any reason to expect that half of the materials are topological for some reason? That there's something, that will make it 50-50, topological, not topological?
No, I mean, I don't know. If you look, I think we had a lower percentage of topological materials when we are looking only at the high-quality compounds.
At the what?
When you were looking at the high-quality compounds, so the one that are published in the Nature paper, which is a smaller subset of what we will put online soon, I think we had much, much less topological materials, on the order of a third. So the new set of materials that we have added have changed a little bit this ratio between topological and trivial material. But no, I don't have any, insight about why this number and not what 62 or 49.
So there is a way that you can tell whether it's topological or not from the elementary event representation already, right? That's how you prepare your training data and your testing data.
Right.
And so my question would be, so how did machine learning help more in this case? Because you can just use the old way to tell whether it's topological or not.
There are a few. I mean, the reason why we are interested in this are twofold. Of course, you can be optimistic and say, "Well, I'm going to bypass ab initio calculation," right? I mean, if you go online, you just provide your information. The answer is automatic. I mean, some of the vast calculation they take a few hours on one of the supercomputers.
I see. So you mean that it's more expensive to do the old way?
Oh yeah. And once the training is done, I mean getting a prediction for one compound is immediate. Like there is zero delay.
I see.
But once again, we have to be careful. The accuracy is only 90% for the time being, and I will double check my calculation. But at least to give you some idea. I mean, what is the probability that the material is topological? But I think the other point is how much insight we can get from this kind of algorithm. I think that's also one of the driving ideas behind using machine learning in physics. It's cool to have something that will help you to solve a problem more quickly, let's say. But we also want to get some new insight of why. I mean, we have that property, for example.
So quick question.
Yeah.
So what's the confidence of your network? I believe you also have a confidence for your result.
Oh yeah. I mean that's We have the world table. I mean the paper. I mean where we discuss exactly how we have obtained this number. So the F1 score I was mentioning is a way to get the confidence.
Okay.
And there is always there's some trade-off I was mentioning about recall and precision. There's also so everything is discussed there about the technical. But that's something we really. We were very careful about the numbers that we give at the end.
Hi.
Oh, no,
very
not
nice
you.
Talk. Actually, I have a question regarding machine learning. So sometimes you have the same compound with the same number of electrons in the same space group, but they have different topological phases.
Correct.
How does the machine deal with this?
So that's why, if you look at the sample size compared to what we have together, it's a bit smaller because we have removed these cases where you, basically, that's the question that was asked first. We know that for some compounds, even if you have the same chemical composition and the same symmetry group, just because the atoms are not exactly at the same position, you might have a different topological classification. So we know that in that case, we need to provide more information than just, you know, what we call the full model. So we have basically, we have decided to, since these are very, I mean, exceptional cases, I'm sure that Nicolas has a number, it's like...
So if you have the same chemistry and the same space group, then 99% of cases have the same couple of sophistication. It looks really very rare.
So these are really rare events. So it was, I mean, we prefer to remove these cases from our study. That's why it's a bit more...
issues about the reliability of GMT in these special cases, because it can happen, you want to see that. You make a very small change in the fraction of coordinates of the...
Yeah, but actually in lead-telluride, if you do that, you will get a ground topological phase because most of the compounds with our calculations belong to a topological phase, and actually it is trivial.
No, I mean, that's also why we have only 90%, and we know that we have at some point to... If you want to go beyond that point, we definitely need to have information about the position of the atoms. Nicolas spent a lot of time using, I mean, different ways to encode this information about the position of the atoms to find what is the relevant one. And at the end, once again, this is trade-off between how much information you provide on top of what you, I mean, as an input, and the size of the sample you can train with. So one way would be, you know, just to do brute force and do some small variation and do the vast calculation to get a much bigger sample. Maybe that would be a way, but that would be really time consuming.
I was wondering, are you limited in your considerations to compounds with a certain number of components, or you allow for many components? This is my first question. And the second is, since these are non-magnetic materials, are your bands Cramers degenerate?
So for the first part, we did put a cutoff.
Sorry?
We have a cutoff because, I mean, you mean like a number of atoms per unit cell?
No, not atoms per unit cell, but a number of components in a compound, different components. So you have two different components in a compound, or three, or how many? Means different A, B, and C.
Different materials.
Different materials, yeah.
Different elements.
Yeah. So we don't have any cutoff apart from, you know, some of the trans Neptunian whatever. So these are the kind of elements that we reject. So when we say that we filter out the 2,000 entries in the ICSD down to 70, we remove some of these cases. We also limit ourselves to materials that have, I think we went up to 60 atoms per unit cell. Yeah. So that's a cap that we put in the calculation. For many reasons. The first one, most of the compounds, when you look at the band structure, is going to be ugly. So I'm not sure how stable is, you know, just the characterization. And then it's very costly, I mean, numerically. So we have removed them arbitrarily. If you look, I don't have the number exactly in mind. So if you think about the ICSD that you can provide to VASP in a clean way, because some of them, for example, they are missing the position of the hydrogen atoms, and so we have discarded them. So this compound with a large number of atoms, maybe it's like a few thousand that we remove at the end of the day. So it's not a large fraction.
Cramer's degeneracy.
So that, I think I will ask to Maya. Yeah. How should I phrase it? So what we did is they do have, but they
you don't or you do?
Do we do?
I think you don't have magnetic materials, so you should have.
Yeah, the magnetic materials. That's what I said. Basically, the magnetic materials will be. I mean, we don't have the way to classify them for the time being. We don't have the analog of the topological quantum chemistry.
But then comes my next question. If you have grounds to degeneracy, you don't have 5 points, or you have 2.5 points, then... If you have Cramer's degeneracy in your bands, the consequence would be you don't have Weyl points, but four-fold degenerate Dirac points.
No.
No. Sorry?
If you don't have inversion.
Acoustically, maybe we can discuss that later.
If you don't have inversion.
Ah.
Which is the case. In some groups that don't have any inversion symmetry.
So maybe, I had one quick question. Mm-hmm. So on this whole business of outsiders question, what is the biggest success story of this topological quantum chemistry or machine learning? What actually has been discovered? Can you give an example? I'm just curious.
So let's say about fragile phases, for example.
About anything. You should just give us an example that was kind of wow. This is great.
Well, I mean, first, the amount of topological materials is surprising.
But is there anything actually discovered?
You mean like experimentally?
Yeah, like material that wasn't known before, now it's known.
Well, we provide like a few, compounds where you do have fragile phases. Uh-huh. Now we have to, to beg the experimentalists to synthesize the materials and to look at them. I mean, this kind of calculation was done like less than a year ago, so...
Yeah, well, that makes sense. On this note, I think we should move to the next talk. Yeah.